This is Andrea. Can I make a suggestion about roll call?
All set to start.
Okay, so we're going to start. The first agenda item is welcome and introductions. So welcome, everybody, on this day, 2 days before the official start of summer. Thank you for being here. And let's start with board members. I don't have all the names in front of me, so Andrea, I heard you.
Andrea North.
Andrea Judith, I heard you. I heard Steve Thal. I heard Randa Utter. I think I heard Beth Rival, yes?
Yes.
Okay. Mary Silverberg?
Mary, yes.
Okay, I don't have everybody. What other board members are here?
Samuel Pride.
Thank you. Anybody else? Good, thank you. Other board members?
David,
thank you. Any other board members? Okay. Besby staff, please.
Brian Sigmund.
Ed Owens.
Andrew Norton.
Tracy Mulroney.
Mary Burgard.
Nancy Mothersfield.
Ray Follett. I'm sorry?
Lisa Takeway.
Okay. Members of the public, please.
Pat Reed, NFB of Connecticut.
Nathaniel Wales, Treasurer, NFB of Connecticut.
Phil McGownick, Vice President, NFB of Connecticut.
Honorata Kazimierczak, NFB of Connecticut.
Francis Lane, NFB Connecticut.
Okay, anybody else? Last call for any attendees who haven't identified themselves.
Tara Brown Ogilvie, Helen Keller National Center.
Excuse me, Eileen. This is Jen.
Yes.
I believe I initially that Christopher Lassen from Besby was also on the call. I'm not sure if he is still.
Okay. Chris, are
yes.
Chris Lassen, are you?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Okay. The next agenda item is public comment. Now, I know that the issue regarding residential accommodations appears later on the agenda. So let's, if there's any public comment about that, let's defer that till we actually discuss that as an agenda item. But is there any other public comment?
Yes, Stephen Paul.
Go ahead, Steve.
I have one thing. I don't know if members got a copy of Andrea's brother's statement about how the safety procedures impact people who are blind. And I think it's well worth reading, and I'd like to see it get up to a higher level. I don't know what your brother can do, Andrea, in terms of him being employed by the University of Maine, what steps he's got to go through, but I think it's well worth it, and it makes the public greater aware of what are some of the issues impacting people who are blind regarding those safety issues.
I do have a copy of that. I don't know if there's any I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. Brian, do you have any guidance on that?
It was actually a very good article. I do not have any additional recommendations on where he could send it, but I think that there are lots of chat sites and other types of venues where that article could be distributed. Andrea probably is the best person to tell us where she has sent it, because she sends it out as a BCC. So I think that we all are receiving it without being aware of just how broadly it already has been circulated.
Thank you, Brian. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. My phone doesn't tell me if it's muted. It just says the word mute. Thank you, Steve, for commenting on that article. It's an amazing article. I'm above and beyond being his sister. I just was blown away by it just as a person who is blind. The fact that he's my brother makes it even cooler. I have shared it with everyone that I can and every single person in my contact. What I can encourage people to do and what Nick has asked me to do is just have everyone share it with anyone they can think of. It has been submitted to some newspapers and other journals, but some of them have a pre-canned of it published somewhere else. But the most important thing is that if you like it, you let other people know about it, whether it's on your social media or just your family and friends. The more people that spread it around, the more people learn the information that's in it, and that's why Nicholas wrote it.
And Andrew, did this get sent out to the board too? Like, I don't know if I saw it. That's odd. This is Catherine.
I'm sorry. I don't actually have. I probably most of you are in my contact list, but I don't actually have everybody's email. So what I can do is,
Andrew, I think I have yours. I can email you.
Okay, that'd be great.
Hey, Brian.
What Nicholas wants is for this to get out to every single person it possibly can.
I have some contacts that won't really like it, so that would be wonderful. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Brian, this is Samuel Pry. Is it possible if you or Lisa forward that article to everybody on the board?
I'm not sure if that's, Brian, would that be appropriate or not?
I don't think there's any issue with Lisa just taking and forwarding it to board members. Board members requested to receive it. So, you know, it's a piece of public information. I think that would be okay.
And Lisa, I can send you a Word document. So if going to the website is complicated, it isn't that hard, but I can also send it to you in a Word document so the entire text of the article is easily accessible.
That would be great. Why don't you forward that to Lisa and I, and then when Lisa sends out the draft, and it's, you know, she'll be sure you all get it. But I think putting it in Word would be very helpful if you could.
Yeah, I've got a text version of it. So
I have a text version as well. Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Other public comment. All right. Hearing none. We'll move on to the next item, which would be minutes from the 19 March 2020 meeting for action. So may I have a motion regarding the minutes from the March meeting, please?
It's Mary Silverberg. I make a motion to accept the minutes.
I second. It's Randa.
Okay. Is there any discussion regarding the minutes? All right, nobody seems to want to discuss the minutes. Therefore, all those in favor of adopting the draft as, adopting the minutes, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Any abstentions? All right, then the minutes have been adopted as published. All right, so the next order of business is Blind Americans Equality Day Work Group Update, which I guess starts with me. First of all, again, I want to say that we have fantastic members in this work group because people are knowledgeable and they're bringing their expertise and their dedication to the work group meetings, and it's been amazing and will continue to be. Of course, the whole planning now is dictated by COVID-19. There's just no question about it.
Yeah.
For example, there will be the governor is not issuing any. Regarding Blind Americans Equality Day, but that's not possible right now.
This is Andrew Norton. Did everyone else lose track of Eileen for about 10 seconds, or just me?
Andrew, I lose track of myself, so.
But it sounded like you said the governor's not doing proclamations. Is that what you said?
That's what I said.
Thank you very much.
And I assume that's correct information, right, Andrew?
It is today, yes. I don't know if it might no longer be true in October, but yes.
Okay. All right, so I am going to ask a couple of work group members to comment briefly on the projects that they have taken the leadership role. So, David, could you comment briefly about the essay contest, please?
Yes. At our last work group meeting, we were shifting away from a contest to make it more of a creative
I'm sorry,
project.
I keep doing that.
creative expression project where, you know, we'll entice the students if they want to submit a drawing or a poem or something. But it's all based around questions that were formulated for three different age groups, the middle schoolers, 7th and 8th grade, the high schoolers, and the post-high school, whether they're in apprenticeship programs or college or something of that nature, and they can answer, you know, their particular questions, or they can answer any question, really, on there. And there's one general question about their interpretation of what Blind Americans Equality Day means to them, and if they've ever participated, and if they were going to, you know, speak to some sort of declaration, what would they say? And we've made some progress, and there's been some changes. And unfortunately, through all this people working remotely, there's been a significant lag time between, you know, I've been working with Catherine and Nancy in emails, and everyone's so busy trying to take care of their responsibilities that we were unable to facilitate a rollout by the 15th, which is what I had hoped, and that's partly on me. So I'm going to retool the rollout memo and send it to you, Eileen, and for dissemination to the board members to make sure I've encapsulated everything, and then we'll just have to proceed accordingly. I'm actually going to have to probably abandon the email chain and just try to set up some sort of conference call with Catherine to get to the nitty-gritty, because she's busy. We're all sort of fumbling around. So the lag has been somewhat disappointing, but it's completely understandable. Well, we'll get it off the ground, and it may benefit the process in the end anyway. So that's where we stand with that. Our goal is to have the essays returned, reviewed, and Nancy has agreed, time permitting and resources permitting, to publish them so that each participant would hopefully have a copy, and we would present a copy to the governor. And Brian has agreed to use VESBE to give each participant a certificate of whether it's completion or appreciation, I don't know what you'd call it, separately. And so the resources are in place. We just have to nail down a more definitive timeline than we had previously, because everything sort of blew up. So that's where we are now.
Thank you. So it's taken on a wider creative aspect than beyond essays, which I forgot to.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember who it was on our working group had an excellent idea. You know, if they want to submit a poem or somehow a drawing, you know, within the realm of what we can actually facilitate for publishing purposes, yeah. And I never gave that a thought, because it started out the genesis with just an essay, but maybe it's more of a creative writing and expression project for Blind Americans Equality Day, and that might spur some more participation and open up their minds a little bit more. So, but it's in essence, it's still an essay project. I expect most of these submissions will be sort of an essay form, but we'll see what happens.
David, thank you for your leadership role in moving ahead with this project. Beyond that, the veterans under the leadership of one of our members, Katie Wiseman, that is proceeding. It's moving forward, and of course, part of that needs what Katie has to go through to get approval but to proceed with that from the veterans group. But that all that is moving forward. So that's definitely another good aspect for Blind Americans Equality Day. Catherine, could you talk briefly about Google Doodle?
Yes. I've gotten a couple of suggestions so far. I sent out an email with the first draft for the Google Doodle request. We decided that we would try to send out this request to try to get Google to do a doodle to honor Blind Americans Equality Day. I think it would be a great way of obviously, getting the attention of the world, really. So this is we're really, really hopeful. As far as I know, I looked up other things that are happening that day, and as far as I'm concerned, none of them are as good a cause as ours. So I think there's really a good chance that we can get their attention and have them vote for this cause. I don't have a good understanding of how long it takes for them to create the doodle, so I'm hopeful that we can get this going and send it off to them, and that they have enough time to have their artists and everything, dealt with to get this going this year. But I do have some connections to Google through my husband and his boss at Bloomberg, so we're hopeful that helps sort of grease the wheels a little bit with our request. So that's where we're at. I sent the first draft to a couple of the advisory board members, so we're hopeful that we can get everyone on board with the correct wording and everything, and then we'll send it up the ladder to the correct people and cross our fingers.
Catherine, could you explain in a sentence or two what other people who are part of the meeting today may not know what Google Doodle is?
What a Google Doodle is. At the top of when you search on a search engine at Google, their name is at the top of the page. And they change it periodically to honor a day or a person or a specific event by changing the name Google to sort of have an image or a movement or something. They change the image to say Google, but with different images of people or things like that. So they'll change the G to look like, Martin Luther King or something like that on Martin Luther King Day or something. So this is the sort of thing we're hoping that they do, is maybe change the L's in Google to look like white canes or something like that. Maybe have underneath Google, maybe it's got a shadow in Braille that says Google. All these different things that could maybe bring the meaning of it to a wider audience. Anybody who goes and searches on Google that day will see that image. And if you click on it, even if you're just sort of using a screen reader, it will read information about the day. Usually they have a link open to different areas about the events of the day. So people have complete control over everything about that. I posted
Now, I don't know about the rest of you, but Catherine, at the end of that, you were breaking up pretty badly.
Oh,
but I think the essence of what you explained got through fine.
Okay.
So thank you again for taking the leadership role in that part of what we're trying to do.
We can get the wording just right.
Right. Thank you so much. For even including a couple of work group members were not present at yesterday's meeting, but what we talked about also was maybe we can find somebody to help create a virtual exhibit for Blind Americans Equality Day. And we specifically were talking about for libraries to publicize, but it could go beyond that, of course. So, but that would be huge we'd have to find a volunteer that might help create a virtual exhibit. But that is very much still in the talking stage. We're talking also about a presence on social media for Facebook, Twitter, etc. And again, it would be the work group that would have to, we'd have to come up with a message that would that could be presented across social media. So that would be another of our ongoing projects. Of course, another one that has come up is accessible voting. And when we started to talk about that as in the work group, it quickly became apparent that that is a broader issue that needs to come before this advisory board. I've done a little bit of talking about this, a little bit of research, and what seems to have happened is that there really hasn't even, again, been much discussion about this on a broader level. Of course, this is a cross disabilities issue. It doesn't just affect the community of people who are blind or visually impaired. It really is a cross disabilities issue. The whole issue of equity in terms of voting, including absentee ballots. And so it was suggested to bring this before this advisory board. So I don't know what, I have no idea. All I can say is that when we had the P&A group, they could more broadly deal with advocacy, but now Disability Rights Connecticut is more a group, as I understand, that would be in charge of if there had to be legal issues, lawsuits, etc. But they don't really do protection and advocacy that I'm aware of. So I am totally at sea in terms of how to proceed with this. I don't know if there would be people first within the advisory board, and then I guess we could open it up to the public right now. But this is still part of the work group. The work group, Blind Americans Equality Day, happens 2.5 weeks before we actually go to vote, and that doesn't even consider the primaries that are coming up in August. But for 99, yes.
It's Mary Silverberg. Yes. I'd like to make, I'd like to add something now. Because on two levels, as a private citizen, I'm saying it specifically because it does make a difference. As a private citizen and voter, I'm not as a board member of NSB. We are both, NSB is taking action. We'll get into that. I'm going to ask maybe one of the other NSB people would like to comment on that. But as a private citizen, because I've worked in accessible voting as a volunteer, training moderators in the past and just being in touch with the Secretary of State's office over the years, I started a dialogue with Janice Merrill, and it became clear very quickly, because she has stated in email, and she stated publicly, she is not in favor of electronic voting. She doesn't feel it's secure. She and the entire office, I don't think they have considered. They just never even thought about it. It's not anybody did anything against anybody with a disability. They never even considered it. And I think it is imperative that as private citizens and as organizations, agencies, in any way, that we can reach them, that they understand what the problem is. Now, I started at the local level, and the attorney, the director of elections, Denise Merrill, you know, try to give them an opportunity. Hey, this is the problem. This is what you are not addressing. Let's do something about it. Yes, we'll listen. We'll talk about it. But we have not had that meeting yet. Are we all still there?
I think so. I think, Mary, that's exactly what I meant when I said there really hasn't been any discussion about this at a public level. So, absolutely, you know.
All right. So what we had, and the towns are waiting. I can tell you this. The towns are not, the individual registrars or voters are not getting guidance, and they're looking for it because they do realize it's a problem. But it's not... You know, it's not the majority's problem, and that's why they're not really looking at it. And I think one of it now, and I indicated to Denise Merrill and to the attorney and the director of elections that here is a lawsuit that occurred in Pennsylvania. We're not just addressing the temporary and permanent issue of using the absentee ballot, but we're talking about people with a print disability being able to vote in the first place. They neglect private and independent. And when that office could say publicly, well, don't you have a trusted friend or relative who could help you vote? See, the law, the intent of the law, the entire thing has escaped them. They need to be reminded. I forwarded to them the results of the lawsuit that was begun in Pennsylvania and in New York. No comment. Now, I would like to pass the torch here to one of the people from NSB because we have, as that organization, have taken it a little bit further.
Well, I'm going to ask, and maybe this will come up. Well, first of all, I want to give anybody on the board a chance if they have anything to say first, and then we can pass it to the public, Mary. But one of my questions when we go forward is, has Disability Rights Connecticut been involved at all in this?
It's Mary. They've been informed, but I think they, as far as I understand, until at least last week, they've chosen not to get involved.
Okay.
And I think they may well at some point. Well, because they don't... Yeah, I think it's under advisement with them at this point. They haven't made a decision to actively get involved.
Okay.
That definite possibility is there.
Eileen? Okay. Before, I would like board members first to have the opportunity to speak. Anybody else on the board?
Yeah, Beth Rival. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh. Mary Ann Melly, the president of NFB, is working on it in negotiations with the way that Pennsylvania and New York has come around this so that we can make it accessible before the elections in August. So we are working on that with our national office, and maybe Philip, our vice president, he's on the line, he can inform us.
Okay, what I would like to know is I think Mary has, and you very completely outlined the issue. Now, my interest I'd like to know going forward is what is your answer? What is your suggestion for making voting accessible? And I guess, Philip, can you comment on that?
Briefly, I was not involved in any of the conversations with Mary Ann with respect to what she's doing. I did see in an email that there was a complaint made to the Department of Justice, and I cannot add any more than what Beth added because I was not involved in the conversation or discussion.
Madam Chair, this is Nathaniel Wales, another officer at NSB. I do have maybe a little bit more information, if that's helpful.
Go ahead.
Sure. Well, thank you, and thank you for bringing up this very important issue. I'm glad I was on the call today. Beth and Mary and Phil are absolutely right. NSB of Connecticut is handling this at the highest level. Our national office is involved. They worked the lawsuit in Pennsylvania and New York, so that they know how to, they're working with us very closely on how to address this. I'll answer the very practical question that you asked, and it's a very good question, and it actually clarifies some confusion that may be occurring. It seems that I know Mary Silverberg, one of our fellow board members, mentioned Denise Merrill's concern about electronic voting. So what I'm about to tell you will actually address that concern. It's frankly a red herring. People talk about electronic voting I'm sorry to say this, and I don't want to get political, but unfortunately the Secretary of State did in her release talking about Russian interference and hacking and all that. So what I'm about to inform you of actually addresses that concern and proves that people who talk about electronic voting are throwing in, whether they realize it or not, whether it's deliberate or not, a red herring. Our solution to the problem is you certainly can vote online and vote electronically. That is certainly an option, and you can even have it sent to your registrar of voters by the website that they printed out in their office so that they have a paper copy of your ballot. That is an option, but that is an option that most states do not use. It is not what Pennsylvania and New York are using. It is not actually what most other states use. What they actually use is a website system that prepares a ballot that you then print and mail. So you might go on. So you'll go on to a website. You'll use your screen reader or screen magnifier to make your selection. But you don't cast your ballot online. Instead of cast your ballot, you hit print and you print it and you mail that back in, just like everybody else mails back in their absentee ballots that they used a pencil to fill out. That is how it's done. The votes are not transmitted, do not necessarily have to be transmitted electronically. They can be transmitted in the mail just like everybody else does. So you could even use the self-addressed stamp envelope that will be sent by the registrar, I guess, postage prepaid and all that, so you don't have to pay postage. But our solution, these are a tried and true systems that have been used in other states for many years, and the whole lot. What we're talking about is not new. It is not unprecedented. It is perfectly workable. Anyone who has access to a computer and a printer can do that. Can go to the library, I suppose, if they needed to do that. And that is our solution, and it's a solution. We're not asking for pie in the sky here. We're just simply asking for what several other states already have, and our national staff is quite familiar with it because most of them are located in Maryland, and that's how they do absentee mail-in voting in Maryland. They go to a website, fill out a ballot, print it, stick it in an envelope, just like everybody else who a ballot by pen and paper. So it's, maybe it's electronic ballot marking, but it's not electronic voting.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yes, that's very helpful. Now, of course, I brought this up under the work group portion of the agenda. Under new business, if a board member wants to make a motion of some kind, that would come under new business. So I'm going to stop discussion of this at this point. I think we've had a pretty rounded discussion. And again, I have to watch the clock here as well. So I'm going to go on and just finishing up the work group report at this point, which is to say our next meeting is going to be on Wednesday, July 15th. So Again, following the agenda as it stands now, I'm going to ask for a bureau update, the first item being the business enterprise program, and then after that would be vocational rehabilitation. So, business enterprise program update, please.
Good morning. This is Ed Owens, the business enterprise supervisor. I have an update. As you can imagine, the last few months have been very difficult for the BEP program. Just like all small businesses, the BEP has been greatly affected by the coronavirus, both in Connecticut and nationally. By the end of March, we had closed most of our 32 locations. Only four of the micro markets remained operational at that time, but their business all but evaporated. The only other location that remained open temporarily was the gift shop at Connecticut Valley Hospital to serve the residents there, but then that one shut down when the hospital went into quarantine. Our seasonal locations at Hammonasset, Rocky Neck, and Gillette Castle, which would normally open up on Memorial Day weekend, have yet to open and are scheduled to open up for the first time next week for an abbreviated season. Now, normally, BEP managers being sole proprietors are generally not eligible for unemployment. However, due to the new federal legislation that was passed, business owners did become eligible. We had several special meetings by teleconference with the managers to advise them of all the benefits that were available to them. The BEP staff worked with all of the managers to assist them in filing for unemployment, which had to take on two steps. First, they had to file for state unemployment and be denied, and then go and reapply for the federal benefit. With the federal process being new, that's something that had to be created, and that opportunity was delayed for a while until Labor Department was able to get their computer system up to date for that. The managers also were inquiring of us if there was any type of financial support we could offer to them, and we worked with the statewide committee of line vendors and came up with a plan to offer each of the BEP managers 1 week vacation pay in lieu of what our normal policy would be to have a field rep cover their location for a week to allow them to be away. So we came up with a figure which is allowed by our regulations. Vacation payment is an option. And the payment was based on the cost of a field rep coverage of the facility. So we were able to provide each of the operators a payment of just over $1,200. Actually, there's no set date for the reopening of facilities. Buildings are just now discussing a repopulation plan, and what that will look like is still unknown. Message is clear for the state buildings. If you have the ability to telework from home, that's the chosen option right now. And we believe that for social distancing reasons, even when the buildings are repopulated, certain segments of the population will continue to work from home. Currently, the focus is on developing a safe plan for people to return to the building, and food service will be addressed, I believe, at a later date. The issues that facilities will be facing will be, number one, adapting to the new and reduced population. What will their menu really look like, and how is it going to be served? There's a whole list of items that have to be addressed in the reopening Connecticut phase two as it applies to restaurants, and this includes the elimination of almost all self-service, including salad bars. All plans for reopening will definitely have to be coordinated through the authority in charge of the building and the local health department. Now, with the closure taking place in March, you can imagine that all of the food inventory at the facilities have been lost, either by perishable or simply going out of date code. So there has to be a funding plan to restock the facilities, which has yet to be developed. Facilities, I believe, will need to start with a much smaller inventory to safeguard that whatever money is invested into inventory is not lost by additional stock going out of code. Now, funding for the BEP primarily comes from the commission from vending machines. The vending machines in the state buildings, which are now, you know, virtually closed. Last month, we saw a $40,000 decrease in our income. With the facilities closed, though, however, our expenditures have decreased in that there's not a lot of our normal repairs aren't being done. Currently, the budget remains stable, although continued shortfalls or any increase in expenses will be a real concern to us. About vending machines, the current vending machine, we have a statewide contract that's put out by the Department of Administrative Services. That's scheduled to expire at the end of this month. They are subsequently working on negotiation for the contract that will follow that one. BEP staff is on the review committee, as is Al Sylvester and Frank Roberts, the chair of our statewide committee of blind vendors. Since the last report, we did close one facility, the snack concession at the labor department. The manager had retired from that location, and the statewide committee of blind vendors did motion not to seek a refill for that location. Prior to the start of the shutdown with COVID and all, we did seek to refill two vacant field rep positions. They were refilled with candidates that have a strong background in food service and management. We hired two new field reps, Joel Garcia and Jesse Towell. Of personal news, I am going to be retiring at the end of this month, as of July 1st. And with that, I'm pleased to announce that Terrell Sampson, who has worked within the program for the last 14 years, will be assuming the supervisory roles in the program. And I believe he's well suited for that position. I do believe Tracy Morin from BEP is on the line, so if I can ask her if she has anything else that she would like to add to the presentation.
Thank you, Ed. I had some notes jotted down, and you did cover them all, so I thank you for that. I can add just as far as the vending machine locations, although commissions have been down the past few months, the rest areas, beach locations, train stations, and bus stations are picking up as people are out traveling about a bit more. So that's all good news.
Thank you. Ed, one of my questions would be, obviously, even when buildings and facilities open up, in view of COVID still dominating so much of our lives, the traffic is, I would think, is going to be a lot lighter. And I'm wondering about how some of these BEP managers are going to be able to make a living if the numbers served could be significantly lower than what had been the populations coming to these facilities. Do you have any comment about that?
That's probably the number one question we're working on. One of the things that we tasked the operators to do was to start to envision what their facility would look like. It would certainly have to change. Certainly some of the larger locations that would normally serve like hot entrees would be doing away with those. They'd have to maybe transition to a more like grab-and-go takeout operation. Unfortunately, what's going to happen, I think, is the operators are not going to be able to bring back the level of staffing that they had before the shutdown, because you know staffing is one of the major costs of the operation and probably will not be as needed with the reduced population. We have to see how everything goes. You know, some of the locations, I was mentioning before to staff that I received notification from judicial that they're going to be repopulating some of their buildings, but they're not interested in having the food service, you know, start right now. So these are things, I think it's going to come in time as more and more people come into the building, but I think you're going to have to retool, and it's going to have to be a different setup. One of the operators was looking at, we use square point of service cash register type things, and said maybe online there's a way to set up a store where people can actually make their order. You list all the items and they order and pay online. One of the things I've been hearing kind of nationally, because we do have four micro markets, is our micro market contact is telling us that a lot of cafeterias, not ours, but a lot of cafeterias in the industry are calling, checking into micro markets as an option. So maybe food service would turn more towards a convenience type store. But have to wait and see how things develop and what the parameters. From what I saw too, though, that when the state buildings open, the seating areas are to remain closed. So They would be looking for people to take it, I don't know, to their desk or to some other, you know, break area.
Matthew.
Yes.
Rival. Just going back, I'm wondering who had to eat the cost of the loss of all the food that the vending operators, did they have to pay for all that stuff that was thrown out?
That's something that we're going to have to address. We've asked them to put together a documented listing of everything that they lost with the cost associated with it. We have been, you know, looking at the program nationally, has been looking at an option of maybe being able to use some federal funds, but I believe that has been, for now, rejected on the federal level. But I know some other organizations are putting forward an effort to have that looked at again. I don't think that in the long run you can hold them accountable. By our regulations, they are responsible for the inventory, but you either have to, in this case, provide an amount of inventory equal to what they lost, or credit their existing inventory for the amount of the loss, which wouldn't be far out of the realm of what we do. I mean, if somebody was to lose something because of a malfunction of a refrigerator, we would take that into consideration on their inventory balance.
All right.
Thank you. Are there other board members with questions?
It's Andrea Giudice. This is just a question that occurred to me. It's not specific to this topic, but we always talk about how the vending machines are in different places. Is there anything on a vending machine that indicates that it's a, you know, that the proceeds support any given organization, or is that just something that's behind the scenes?
How did you get it?
Yeah, as a requirement, there is a sticker on every machine, and that is required on every machine. which says, your purchases from this machine creates opportunities for people who are blind. And then it has the old BESDI logo, and it says Board of Education Services for the Blind.
Okay, cool. It never occurred to me to think that that might be on there, and I think that's cool that it is, because then people, you know,
yeah.
it's just more information.